From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, baseball's all-time hit leader, Pete Rose. He was banned from baseball 14 years ago when he was accused of gambling on the game. He also spent 5 months in prison on tax charges. In his new book, My Prison Without Bars, he admits for the first time he did bet on baseball. He'll talk about how he played the game, how he copes with the ban, and why some in the baseball world aren't buying his apology. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about Bobby Patterson, a little-known Texas soul singer from the 60s whose music deserves a bigger audience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination are fanning out to campaign in the 7 states that will hold primaries or caucuses next Tuesday. John Edwards is campaigning today in 3 states. The North Carolina senator finished 4th in yesterday's New Hampshire primary. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
Edwards is visiting 3 states with primaries next Tuesday: Oklahoma, Missouri, and his birthplace of South Carolina. At South Carolina State University, the senator said he was happy with the New Hampshire results, in which he finished behind John Kerry, Howard Dean, and Wesley Clark.
Now the job that all of us have to do is continue this momentum, this energy, and this campaign here in the state of South Carolina, the state of my birth, where I'm very proud to be back today.
Edwards says a South Carolina victory is essential to his campaign. But he suffered a disappointment when South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn, an influential African-American leader, endorsed Senator Kerry. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Columbia, South Carolina.
Former U.S. Weapons Inspector David Kaye says U.S. intelligence failed the country when it came to Iraq. He told the Senate Armed Services and Intelligence Committees today that the United States wasn't the only country that was wrong about Iraq's weapons capability.
Many governments that chose not to support this war, certainly the French, President Chirac, as I recall, in April of last year, referred to Iraq's possession of WMD. The German, certainly the intelligence service, believed that there were WMD. It turns out we were all wrong.
Kaye rejected suggestions that the White House manipulated intelligence to justify the war in Iraq, and he says he would back an investigation into intelligence failures. There's a new variant of the computer worm known as MyDoom. This version is programmed to attack the website of the Microsoft Corporation. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
MyDoom began spreading rapidly on Monday. The program arrives via email and only spreads if users click on the attachment to the message. It spreads to addresses stored on the hard drive of the infected computer and via the peer-to-peer file-sharing network Kazaa. The first variant of MyDoom was programmed to attack the website of SEO Group, a software company that claims copyright ownership of some Unix-based software. This second version of the worm is programmed to go after Microsoft's website. Both attacks are scheduled to begin on February 1st and end on the 12th. The worm only attacks machines running Microsoft's Windows operating system. Users can avoid attack by simply deleting the email or by using free removal tools distributed by antivirus companies. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 141 points, or 1.3%, to close at 10,468. The NASDAQ was down 38. This is NPR News. A German Air Force plane has arrived in Beirut, Lebanon, to pick up an Israeli businessman who's been held hostage since October of 2000. And the plane will also pick up the remains of 3 Israeli soldiers. The Lebanese guerrilla group Hezbollah disclosed for the first time today that the men were killed in an ambush in 2000. The Israelis are part of a prisoner exchange in which Israel agreed to release 436 Arab prisoners who will be flown to a German airbase. Thailand has hosted an international meeting on bird flu in an effort to prevent the spread of the virus. Bird flu has been confirmed in 9 Asian countries since its outbreak earlier this month. Dwathli Saikauta reports from Bangkok.
Thaksin Shinawat today said Thailand was lucky to emerge from the SARS crisis without any local transmission of the severe acute respiratory syndrome. It is not the case this time with bird flu. Thaksin's opening speech to the ministers and senior officials made clear that transparency was key to controlling the outbreak. He said whatever may have happened in the past, this is what the Thai government is doing right now. Thailand has been accused of covering up bird flu for weeks while victims fell ill to the deadly disease. Bird flu has spread quickly through Asia, with Laos announcing most recently that it had cases of bird flu in its chicken population. Thaksin said to contain the fast-spreading virus, countries need to respond promptly, act with transparency, and share information. For NPR News, I'm Dwali Saikautau in Bangkok.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 38 points, or 1.8%, to close at 2,077. The S&P 500 lost 15 to close at 1,128. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is baseball legend Pete Rose. His new book with writer Rick Hill, My Prison Without Bars, is part of a campaign to end Rose's 14-year exile from the game and make him eligible to manage again and be voted into baseball's Hall of Fame. As a player, Rose was known for his hustle, and his belly-flopping head-first slides were a crowd-pleasing signature. His accomplishments on the field place him among the game's all-time elite. He was Rookie of the Year, earned three batting titles, and was named an All-Star at five different positions, playing in 17 All-Star games altogether. And he's baseball's all-time hit leader with 4,256, more than Stan Musial, more than Ty Cobb, more than anybody. But Rose's life and career unraveled in 1989. Baseball Commissioner Bart Giamatti launched an investigation which developed evidence that Rose was a heavy gambler, that he was in debt to illegal bookmakers, and that he'd probably bet on baseball. Rose fought Giamatti in court, but eventually agreed to a settlement in which he was banned from baseball for life, though he could apply for reinstatement. Rose did 5 months in prison on tax charges, but he denied betting on baseball then and for the next 14 years. He finally admits the deed in his new book, but some in the game have found his explanations and his apology inadequate. I spoke to Rose last week. Pete Rose, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
Good to have you. You know, I'm going to share with you my favorite Pete Rose memory as a player. It was an at-bat late in an inning. You were playing for the Phillies, and I don't remember the team you were playing against, but the situation was it was late innings. The Phillies were down several runs. And what you needed to do in that situation was get on base, not get a double, not get a triple, just find a way to get to first base, a walk, a hit batsman, anything. The pitcher makes a mistake. You're batting left-handed, I believe, throws it at your right calf. And knowing the game situation, in the split second it takes you to react, your leg doesn't move because you know that if you're hit, you're on first base. The ball whacks your leg hard, flies 30 feet away. You glare back at the pitcher, fling the bat to the side, sprint to first. That's a kind of focus that's really unique in the game. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think gives you that kind of single-minded focus on baseball when you were a player?
Well, I think the fact that my top priority playing the game of baseball was always, one, to be involved in the game, knowing the situation of the game, and two, and probably most importantly, always wanting to win the game. I think that's why you play the game of sports, especially professionally, is someone's got to win, someone's got to lose, and I always recommended winning a lot more than I did losing.
And you worked at it. I mean, you
yes.
studied every pitcher. You charted every
pitch.
Well,
yeah, you have
right?
to. Yeah, it's your occupation. I mean, there's only 10 pitchers. There's only 10 pitchers in your league, and there's 15 teams, so there's only 150 pitchers that you have to have written down in the back of your head. And the guys I had trouble with were rookie pitchers until I saw them once. And once I saw them, because for Dave Davies to tell me this guy's got a fastball, breaking ball, and a changeup doesn't mean anything until I see, is his fastball a sinker? Is it a straight fastball? Is it a sailing fastball? You know, is it a riser? Or is his curveball a downer? Is it a sidewinder? And so you have to see and get firsthand experience what the guy's ball does.
You write that when there was a rain delay, other guys would be playing cards in the clubhouse. You'd find a way to get to the cage and take batting practice. You just never
Well, sometimes. It's not all the time. Now, what I said, you probably read what I said, is a lot of times during rain delays nowadays, because of the indoor batting cages they have underneath the stadiums, I mean, I know several times during rain delays, I was in the batting cage throwing Joe Morgan extra batting practice because he, might have been a little bit of a slump at the time. Not a lot of times with Joe Morgan, but more than twice. And then he would do the same for me. So the best time to work on your swing, Dave, is during the game if you can, and the only time you can is a rain delay, or right after the game. You know, I used to take my extra batting practice right after the game because it's fresh on my mind what I'm doing wrong. And you're still all leathered up from the game. And if you go take your shower and go home and come to the ballpark the next day, well, one, you're going to do it so much you're going to be tired for the game. And two, you might have forgot what you were doing wrong from the time you left the ballpark the night before. So I always thought that the best time to take extra batting practice to work on a slump, if you were in one, was right after the game.
You know, I mentioned the focus because you write in the book that you now suspect you had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I mean, do you think that you had a different kind of mental attitude and focus? I mean,
well, I think I had a different mental attitude based on my upbringings. I had a defiant mother and a super, super, super aggressive father that hated to lose, and that was instilled in me and my brother and my two sisters all while we were growing up. I mean, religiously, my dad was a basketball player. I was the ball boy. I was a water boy on the football team. I was bat boy on the baseball team. And I can remember his attitude when they would lose a game on the way home. He wasn't the same person. He wasn't nasty, but he just wasn't in as good a mood when he lost the game as opposed to when he won the game. If he's in a bad mood, then that would put my mom in a bad mood because she wanted to be around a positive situation.
So winning was a prerequisite to comfort and happiness. How would you react?
Yes.
How would you react after you, if you ever made a mental error or just
blew it? Well, it bothered me. It bothered me because, one, physical errors are part of the game. And I always thought if you made mental errors that you were letting down the pitcher. And if I made a mental error, it would bother me more if I struck out four times, especially if we lost the game because of a mental error. Because if you understand the game and you practice the game the right way and you study the game, you should know what base to throw to, when not to get thrown out at second or get thrown out at third, different things that are mental errors. And there's a lot of mental errors made every day, and it's okay to make a mental error, but once you make that mental error, you got to write that down in the back of your head and don't do it again.
I think you're right in the book. You'd be hell at home. You'd stomp around and finally have to let out a big scream sometimes.
Yeah, because my wife could actually tell, not if I struck out four times or if I got four hits, but she could tell if I made a blunder, it cost us a game. Because I would take that away from the ballpark. I wouldn't take striking out four times away from the ballpark, or I wouldn't take going 4-for-4 away from the ballpark. That was part of the game, but. Because I just felt like when you made mental errors, you're letting people down who have families too, and those people you let down because of a mental error are usually the pitchers.
Right. I wanted to ask about your relationship with Mike Schmidt. He was, of course, one of the greats of the game, a Hall of Fame third baseman. Now, he has been one of your staunchest defenders and advocates in all the controversies you've faced. I mean, really advocated for you to get back into the game.
Right.
You write that when you joined the Phillies in 79, Schmidt was already an all-star and a big player. You describe him as a guy who was the greatest player on the field 3 days a week. But when you got there, you made him a great player every day. How?
Well, I think I helped him. See, what happened, Dave, is, Mike Schmidt, when I got there, was a great player. I mean, as a matter of fact, he's the greatest player I ever played with. And he's the greatest third baseman ever to play the game of baseball. But Mike had to understand that regardless of how good he played, he was only going to hit from 40 to 50 home runs, and you play 162 games. But what I made Mike understand is you can win games with your leadership. You can win games with your glove. You can win games with your speed. You can win games hitting home runs.
Did you teach him that by talking to him or by just showing
him? Yeah, sure. I used to go out and eat with him all the time. Him and we were like Mutt and Jeff. And I think you have to understand another thing about the Phillies, Boa, Leszczynski, Maddox, Boone, McBride, Schmidt, trio. All they knew about me when I came to Philadelphia is what they saw 12 times a year. That's all we played. The Eastern Division teams was 12 times a year. And when I went to Philadelphia and played in 1979, I hit over 330, I believe. I got over 200 hits. And they saw me play every day. And I played the same way every day. I remember one time that year I was summoned with divorce papers in New York. And I proceeded to go like 20 for 28. And I remember a beau or somebody asked me, how in the hell can you go 20 for 28 when they just served you for a divorce? I said, well, let me ask you a question. If you're going to get divorced, is it better to hit 300 or 200? And I made my point. So they saw me play every day, and it took me a year to be there before we went to the World Series. And as you know, the next year we went to the World Series, and Mike Schmidt was most valuable player.
My guest is baseball legend Pete Rose. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is baseball's all-time hit leader, Pete Rose. His new book is My Prison Without Bars. Now, Pete, you say you were around gambling a lot as a kid. Tell me...
Well, let me rephrase that, okay?
Okay.
I was around going to the races.
Okay.
You know, when I was a kid, I didn't know anything about, or my dad knew anything about bookmakers or casinos weren't a big thing or anything like that. But most of the guys in our neighborhood would patronize the races periodically, not on a daily basis, because my dad was a banker and he went to the bank Monday through Friday, but every once in a while on a Saturday or Sunday with Don Zimmer's dad, Dud, they would go over to, at that time, it was called Latonia.
Right.
And he would take me with him.
Okay, so not immersed in gambling, but it was sort of
right.
a part of the culture there in your neighborhood in Cincinnati.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, when you write about... coming up as a minor leaguer, and you moved up very quickly to the majors, I mean, because,
right.
you know, the hustle and talent you showed. Were you betting then? Were you gambling then at all? I mean, as a young player?
I don't think you're talking about the minor leagues?
Well, the minor leagues in your early years in the majors, in the 70s, yeah.
Well, I think my early years in the majors, when we went to spring training, most all the players were at the dog track every night, St. Pete, one, because they had the best – prime rib you could ever taste, and two, it was just where everybody went to do things at night. I mean, just you know, Joe Torre was there and Zimmer was there and a lot of my teammates were there. I mean, you know, you wouldn't go by yourself, but and you didn't go every night, mostly weekends.
Right. I mean, gambling, of course, was a legal activity in all these places,
yeah.
and a lot of people did
yeah.
it. But clearly, right. at some point, it became a different part of your life, and that's kind of what I wanted to get to. I mean, you described yourself as a recreational gambler a lot of those
right.
years.
Yeah.
When did it get different? When did it become a problem?
Well, I think in the latter part of the 80s, I just got a little bit out of control. I started got associated with the wrong people, and just started wagering a little bit too much.
Do you have an insight into sort of how that happened? Was there something in your life that drove you to do that?
The only thing I could think of is that I was through as a player. Up till, 87, I was a player. And once I stopped playing, stopped taking batting practice, stopped taking fielding practice, things like that, I had a void there. And I just had more time to think.
The back picture of your book is you standing on first base after you finally broke Ty Cobb's record, the all-time
right.
hit record. And your mm-hmm. hand is over your face because the tears are coming. You're thinking of your
right.
dad.
Mm-hmm.
But you write in the book that when you finally broke that record, you felt a letdown. I don't mean that moment, but in the days and weeks that followed, there was a letdown you felt. Describe that. Why was that?
Well, because there was such a buildup to the record. I mean, I had hundreds of writers following every move that I made. And, that's one of the most coveted records there ever was in baseball. The reason I survived as a baseball player is I always needed challenges. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
I wanted to be the first singles hitter to hit 100,000. I wanted to be the all-time hit leader. I wanted to be the all-time this guy. I wanted to play five different positions. And, you know, not right when I did it, but after I did it, always left is, what is the final number going to be? You know, I run out of challenges.
Right.
Individual challenges.
No worlds left for Pete to conquer, right?
Well, except to get my team to the World Series, because I was in charge of the team.
See, right.
I was a player manager at that time in 85, and I was a player manager in 86, then I quit playing for the 87 season.
You know, on in every major league clubhouse, the rule is posted there. Rule 21, I guess it is, that says that that gambling on baseball is the basis
right.
for a lifetime suspension. I mean, you knew the rule well. What caused you to cross the line and
well, I don't know if I knew the rule. I don't know if I knew the rule well. I should have, and that was my ignorance. I would be surprised, if you took a survey of the 750 baseball players today, how many of them would know that rule? I would really be surprised. I would, because I don't think we as players take a lot of time to read those kind of rules. Because I remember in the Cincinnati clubhouse, it was kind of a lot smaller than it is today. And I just wonder how many players really take time to read that rule.
Right, but as far
but
back...
That don't make it right. That don't make it right. I was still wrong. I understand that. But, you're right. I broke the rule.
But I mean, as far back as the 1970s, I mean, the commissioner of baseball then, he had a... you know, kind of a rule-enforcing fella appointed who had a lot of conversations with you about suspicions that you were involved in gambling. I mean, you must have had conversations about that rule then. I can't imagine it wasn't pretty deeply impressed upon you, the seriousness.
Well, I didn't have suspicions about that rule. I had the commissioner's security guy come into Cincinnati one time, and the reason he came in because they got a tip that I owed bookmakers money. And I actually took this guy around to the two guys in question who were friends of mine, and they both concurred what we knew, that I owed them no money, and baseball was happy with that.
All right, so you're saying that when you did make the mistake, what you now acknowledge was a terrible mistake of betting on baseball, you weren't really aware of how serious an issue it would be?
If I got caught, yes, but, you know, I forgot the boundaries. I got out of the boundaries. I wish it could happen, change
sure.
it, but I just can't change it. I had to live with it. I got it off my shoulders now. I'm happy.
When the commissioner appointed John Dowd to investigate, and Ron Peters and some other people got into legal troubles and told both the baseball commissioner's investigators and IRS investigator stories about you, you ended up being charged with tax evasion and spending 5 months in prison, which you described as being on a humiliation diet.
Well, first of all, I don't think it was tax evasion, because the term is I left items off my tax return, because evasion means you evade taxes. And the years in question, I paid $2.2 million in taxes, and they said I owed them $2.362. Okay, so we'll get that terminology right, because tax evasion is a lot worse than leaving items off of your tax form.
So an omission, right?
Yes.
You know, of all the days you were a player, I mean, a lot of people said a lot of great things about your playing attributes, but I don't think humility was something that came to mind quickly when you talked about Pete Rose. And when you're in prison, you're stripped of your dignity, you have no control over your time, your schedule, when you can be body searched. How did you handle that?
Well, you know, that's the cards I was dealt. I'm not a whiner. I made a mistake. I mean, I underpaid my taxes by 3.5%, and that was wrong. And I paid, by the way, I paid $366,000 2 weeks before I was sentenced, and I only owed $162,000. So I paid $204,000 in interest, penalties, and fines, and they still sent me to prison. You hear what I said? I underpaid my taxes by 3.5%.
Right.
Don't you hope we get 97% of our taxes from everybody this year?
Yeah, well, I guess their attitude probably depends on how much that adds up to. I mean, you were making a pretty substantial income at the time with baseball. And
I just told you, I owed him $162,000.
Right, right.
That's three appearances.
Oh, three appearances at card shows and memorabilia shows.
Yeah.
Right, okay. You didn't gamble at all when you were in your prison, I take it. What about when you were at the halfway house and in community service? Did you find Did you find you wanted to gamble again, and did you?
No. I have done no illegal gambling since 1988. The only kind of gambling I do today is I periodically go to the races because I own a couple racehorses out in California at Hollywood and Santa Anita Park. That's the only kind of recreational gambling I do today.
Okay. But you've made some casino appearances. You ever hit the tables there?
Nope. I make casino appearances, and I told someone this about an hour ago. It was 4 months ago or 3 months ago, whenever Evander Holyfield fought James Toney for the heavyweight championship at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, was the only time I've ever walked through a casino that I wasn't getting paid.
I guess what I'm curious about, I mean, what you're telling me is that your conduct is highly regulated and you're not gambling like you used to be. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is, for a guy who, at his baseball career, was so focused, so committed to doing everything mm-hmm. he needed to do to win, and so careful and conscientious, to have gotten as careless as you ultimately did to bet on baseball and to bet as frequently as you did on a lot of things, suggests that you did have a gambling problem. I mean, that there must have been some compulsion that made you make a lot of bets and a lot of fairly big bets. And I'm wondering how you tamed that demon. I mean, do you no longer feel like you need to get in the action every day?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that if you're inside my head and you lose what I lose, and as you sit here and talk to me today, I'm 62 years old now, all right? I'm a little different than I was when I was 42 or when I was 32 or when I was 50. And you see things from a different perspective. And I don't want to go through what I went through the last 14 years. And if you start gambling again, that's what's going to happen. And I'm smart enough to understand that.
Right.
I mean, that's the way I look at it. I don't have no desires to bet on a Super Bowl or bet on a basketball game or bet on I have no desires to do that. It's no fun for me anymore. Yeah. I don't get the kick out of it.
Right. I mean, you used to write that you used to watch a lot of sports, and it was always a little more fun to watch a game if you had some action on it.
What I do now, that's a good point, and you're absolutely right about that. But what I do now is I have an association with so many athletes, okay? If Brett Favre's on, I'm going to watch him because I like Brett Favre and I'm a friend of his. Or if Donovan McNabb's on, I'm going to watch him. Or if Warren Sapp's a good friend of mine, Mike Allstadt's a good friend of mine for the Tampa Bay Bucks. So I'm going to watch and root for the guys. Shaq's a good friend of mine. So when the Lakers are on, I'm going to watch the Lakers play and root for the Lakers. You know, I don't sit home and watch sports as much as I used to, with the exception of baseball. And I watch more baseball than anybody because I'm always thinking I'm going to get back into baseball, and I want to know what's going on with the different players.
It's not painful to watch the game knowing that you
not at all. It's not painful. It's fun. Baseball is a fun game to watch. And when you know it like I know it, it's exciting to watch it. I can't blame, baseball for what happened to me. I'm the problem. I'm the one that caused what happened to me. Why should I take it out on baseball?
Pete Rose. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Pete Rose. They'll talk about how baseball writers and other ballplayers are reacting to his apology. His new book is My Prison Without Bars. And rock historian Ed Ward on the career of Texas soul singer Bobby Patterson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's return to my conversation with baseball's all-time hit leader, Pete Rose. Rose hopes to convince baseball's commissioner, Bud Selig, to end his lifetime ban from the game. In his new book, My Prison Without Bars, Rose chronicles the gambling addiction that got him into trouble and apologizes for betting on baseball. He says he's changed his life, but critics note that Rose still bets at racetracks and that he lied about the depth of his gambling problem in the past. When Commissioner Giamatti brought the issue about your gambling, there was eventually a settlement in which you were banned with the understanding that you could apply for reinstatement. There was not an admission that you'd bet on baseball.
Right.
Although you then told the public that you didn't, and he, I believe, expressed an opinion that you probably had. But that was the situation for years. Now, in 1999, you and your attorney, Roger Makely, made an overture to Commissioner Bud Selig to see if there was a way to resolve this, get you back into the game. You spent a long time out in the hinterlands. You found that, and you'd assembled evidence challenging the report that they had prepared, the Dowd report, which brought all the supposed the evidence against you for gambling.
Right.
You found that they weren't interested in the evidence that they had. They wanted to see evidence of a life transformation. What did you take that to mean?
Well, it's the same thing I took when Bart Giamatti told me to reconfigure my life. If he tells you to reconfigure your life and you know what you did, I assume that means no more illegal gambling and be very selective of people you associate with. And I've done both of those things.
Right.
So I've reconfigured my life the way I think he would have wanted me to, but he never did. Reconfigure can mean a lot of things. But based on what happened to me, I have to believe that the two basic things was no more illegal gambling and be very selective of associations.
Well, I could imagine that Commissioner Selig saying, you know, Pete, I know that's true. I mean, that is a different life. But if we reinstate you, and gambling becomes an addiction again or a problem, or you bet on baseball, I'm going to be embarrassed. And someone who's had a problem with gambling, I'd really like to know that they're finished with it completely, that maybe they're going to Gamblers Anonymous meetings, that they really purged that from their life, particularly given that, you know, you now admit that for 14 years you weren't telling the truth about whether you'd bet on baseball. I mean, can you see how someone would look at this and say, you know, Pete, you really got to get gambling out of your life and convince us it's never going to be a problem again?
Well, I try to explain all that in my book. If you read it, I mean, I try to get you to try to understand my life. But I'm sure there's people who are going to sit there and say what you just said until I die. I can't change those people. I can't change those people.
I guess what I'm asking is, I mean, if getting out of gambling...
And the last thing in the world I want to do is embarrass the commissioner. I know how he's going out on a limb for me. You just have to know me. You have to know me. I mean, And you said I went around the last 14 years saying this or saying that. Do you know for a fact that if I'd have been given the opportunity in 1992 to talk to the commissioner, I wouldn't have come clean? You don't know that.
No, we'll never know.
Nobody
that.
Knows that. Nobody knows that. I was given the opportunity 15 months ago. That's why I came clean, because that was the first time I was given an opportunity to talk to the commissioner. In my eyes, the only guy in charge of my life is the commissioner of baseball, not you, not Bob Costas. Right. Not Jim Gray. Right. You guys can't help me.
Right.
I mean, people says, well, in 95, why didn't you just come out and make a statement you bet on baseball? Well, you're going to go over the commissioner's head? What kind of insanity is that?
Well, tell us about that meeting when you finally got the chance. I mean, for years, Silly would not even return your phone calls or letters. You finally had a chance to meet with him. And you write that there was a moment when you sent all the lawyers, everybody else out of the room. It was just you and him.
Well, I didn't. He did.
He did. All right.
Yeah, I didn't send anybody out of the room.
Well tell us.
And by the way, there was no lawyers in the room, just Bob DuPay, Warren Green, Mike Schmidt, and myself.
Okay.
Okay, so there's no lawyers in the room. I guess Bob DuPay's a lawyer, but that's the only lawyer, and he's Bud Selig's right-hand man. And Bud asked him to leave, and then him and I had a heart-to-heart talk. I was in a scary situation for me because my whole life up to that time was baseball. And all of a sudden, that's taken away from me. I can't work in baseball, and I'm 45 years old. What the hell am I going to do for a living?
You write that your dad was your role model and your inspiration, and he died early in your baseball career. It was a hard blow for you.
1970.
Right. Do you think if he'd lived, it would have made any differences in the life choices that you made?
Yeah, I think so, because my dad's the type of guy that if he didn't think I was associating with the right people, he'd have told me. He'd have called me off to the side and told me. And I would have listened to him because he's the only person I've ever idolized in my life. And he had a lot of common sense. I can talk about my dad all day and all night, Dave, because, you know, we're all going to die. But I have so many fond memories of my father that I don't even think about him laying up there at the funeral home. You understand what I'm saying? Because, you know, I repaid him. He repaid me. He got to see me play in All-Star games. He got to see me play in a World Series. He got to go to spring training several years. You know, so I kind of paid him back for everything he did for me. You know, I can never pay him back for everything that he did for me. But I kind of got even with him a little bit, but never enough. And because of that, I can talk about my dad all day and not get tears in my eyes because I have nothing but fond and good memories of my dad.
My guest is baseball legend Pete Rose. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is baseball's all-time hits leader, Pete Rose. His new book is called My Prison Without Bars. You know, people write books for a lot of reasons. I mean, this is your second. One of the reasons, of course, is to sell copies. But this book of yours is different, I think. I mean, there was a mission here. You wanted to tell the truth, apologize, right, and strengthen your case to return to baseball. And there are a lot of ways to apologize, of course, a lot of ways to tell a story. And I'm wondering if you thought much and talked to your collaborator much about how best to, you know, well, pardon the expression, but to package this apology so that, you know, it would help you get where you want to be, which is back in baseball.
Before the people are misled here, there's only three chapters about gambling. So you got to remember, the book is about 62 years of my life. It's just not about the gambling allegations.
Right, although, I mean, a lot of it does involve some of the controversies that came from it. I mean, you know, you wrote an earlier book about baseball. I mean, it's a very different experience to have to go to prison, and I think those are told well. Probably the most quoted part of the new book in the immediate aftermath of its release was where you say that, you know, that maybe you ought to bear your feelings a lot more, but that you're just not built that way, and right, now let's move on. And that's provoked something of a reaction. What do you make of the reaction to that, Pete?
Well, here's the way I look at it, that some guys that read the book think I'm remorseful enough. Other guys don't think I'm remorseful enough. Now, I could have took and said I'm sorry in a different way in 10 or 12 more pages. Then I could just hear him saying how phony I am. I'm not a real remorseful type guy. The picture on the back page, it took an eight and a half minutes of a 9-minute standing ovation to make me cry. I don't go to movies and cry. I'm not a crier. I'm not a hugger. You know, my dad never hugged me and kissed me and told me he loved me. I knew he did, but I do it to my sons. I mean, I tell them I love them, I hug them, I kiss them, but I'm just not a real delicate type guy. And if I was, I wouldn't have got 4,200 hits. I mean, I'm a baseball player. You know, I'm not an author. I'm not a politician. You know, I'm a baseball player. And it takes a lot for me to say I'm sorry. Dave, it's hard to put down remorse on a piece of paper. You know, it's easy for you to see me being remorseful if I'm on Charles Gibson or Bill O'Reilly or this show or that show because you're looking at my face, you're listening to my voice. Or on the radio, they're hearing my voice. You know, you can say, Dave, I'm really sorry I've been on baseball. I wish I could change it. Or, Dave, I've been on baseball. I wish I could change it. See how that sounds? I mean, it's two different philosophies.
But on a page, it's what it is.
Yes, on a page, you have to know the person to understand it. And I can give you an illustration there. I mean, one of my best friends made some quotes, Joe Morgan. And they put his his quotes and headlines, but if you read the whole quote, Joe says this and he says that. I don't show much remorse. And then he says, however, I haven't read the book yet or saw the Charles Gibson interview.
Right.
But that's in real small print. It's all interpretation. It's how you want to read it. I mean, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all how you want to read it.
Well, another issue.
How did you read it? Let me ask you. You don't know me, but how did you read it?
Well, at times I thought you were really trying to get at what made you tick, and I thought that was really interesting.
Okay. That's good.
And I'm not sure how you apologize deeply enough to make everybody happy.
Well, that's the point. You're absolutely right there, Dave. That's the point. How can you do it? What's the fine line to make everybody happy? What's the fine line where I don't overdo it? Then the guys in the media say, what a phony-ass book that is. That's not Pete Rose getting down on his hands and knees and begging. That's not him. You understand what I'm saying?
That was
tough about writing this book because my personality is who I am, and my personality is how I act.
Maybe the mistake was the three words, let's move on.
I'm trying to move on. I'm trying to move on, but, you know, I'm sitting here talking to you.
But I guess people
all you're doing is relishing in the past. I want to move on. I got a clean slate. I'm trying to move on. Why won't anybody let me move on? All I've been hearing, Dave, for the last 14 years, George Bush even said it on Bob Costas, if Pete comes clean, give him a second chance and let him go on with his life. Well, I've come clean. Now, what's the problem now?
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody's finding out different things. The book came out at the wrong time, and I used the book to tell the people. That's all bull. That's all not true. It's not true.
Well, the timing of the book wasn't. I mean, Dennis Eckersley, who was recently inducted into the Hall of Fame, kind of had a couple of nasty things to say. He felt that the book being released now overshadowed his and Paul Molitor's induction into to the Hall. Is that something that you thought about ahead of time?
You mean if it came out on the 8th? That's when it came out, on the 8th. And they came out on the 6th. What's the difference if I come out on the 8th or the 10th? Or, you know,
maybe next month would have been better. I don't know.
Okay, then they just said I'm trying to get all the publicity from spring training. Or if I waited to the All-Star game, I'm trying to take away from the All-Star game. Or if I waited to the World Series, I'm trying to take away from the World Series. I can't help it that there was a leak and my publisher decided to have the guy from Sports Illustrated on Monday instead of Wednesday. Okay, that's what happened.
So a matter of a couple of days made a difference.
In their eyes they did. Do you think that I have the power to tell the publisher who puts up hundreds of thousands of dollars to do this book, when to come out with the book? I wish I was that strong. And anybody that knows me, why would I want to steal the thunder from Dennis Eckersley and Paul Molitor in January?
Mm-hmm. You know, you've written in the book that your reaction to trouble is to fight. I mean, that's served you well all your years. But it seems that now you're in a situation where to get where you need to be, you end up having to do this campaign of humility and It's all about compromise.
I'm through fighting. I mean, I'm going to let you guys, you know, the only thing I hope, and it seems like you're pretty good at it, and that hope is that you know the facts, that you tried it. It's amazing how many people in the media today do not operate on facts, yet they have a forum, and they get up on their soapboxes and just keep talking and keep talking and keep saying the wrong things that aren't right. And everybody listens to him. I'm not concerned about that for this reason, is because every book signing I've had so far is a sellout.
Your fans
those
are still
the
there.
People, those are the people that mind, that I care about. Those are the fans.
Your son Petey made a run at a professional baseball career. In fact, I saw him once playing double-A ball in Reading, Pennsylvania. I'm wondering what impact you think both your fame and achievements and your problems had on him and his ability to make it.
Well, that's a good question, and I appreciate you thinking about him. But, he went through hell. He went through hell for a couple years, and that's one thing that I don't like about some fans. But it wasn't a majority of fans, because fans can be cruel, as you know, being in Philadelphia. Fans are good there, but they get a bad rap. But the situation there was no one knew where I was at, but they knew where he was at. And they kind of took it out on him. But I told him one time, I said, Petey, listen, you're going to go through some hell. I said, but the rewards are a lot better being Pete Rose as opposed to not being Pete Rose. And he loves his dad, and he listened to me, and he went on with his life. And he's still playing baseball. He has a dream. That's to play in the big leagues. And I'm not going to tell him, I don't care if he's 33, 34. If your dream and you believe you can make the big leagues, keep after your dream. Keep after your dream.
Pete Rose, thanks much for joining us.
Dave, thank you for being fair, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Pete Rose, his new book written with Rick Hill is My Prison Without Bars. Last week, the prolific music arranger Billy May died at the age of 87. Early in his career, he worked with the Glenn Miller and Les Brown bands. Later, he joined Capitol Records, where he became best known for his work with Frank Sinatra. He also arranged for Nat King Cole and Peggy Lee. Let's listen to this 1951 recording of Walking My Baby Back Home, recorded by Nat King Cole with orchestration arranged and conducted by Billy May.
G is great after being out late, walking my baby back home. Arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home. We go long harmonizing a song, or I'm reciting a poem. Hours go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home. We stop for a while, she gives me a smile, snuggles her head on my chest. We startin' to pet, and that's when I get her talcum all over my vest. After I kinda straighten my tie, she has to borrow my comb. One kiss, then I continue again, walking my baby back home. The dark, so I have to park outside of her door till it's light. She says if I try to kiss her, she'll cry. I dry her tears all through the night, hand in hand to a barbecue stand. Right from her doorway we roam. Eats and then it's a pleasure again, walking my baby, talking my baby, loving my baby. I don't mean maybe, walking my baby back home.
Nat King Cole recorded in 1951. Coming up, Ed Ward tells us about a soul singer who deserves a wider audience. This is Fresh Air. Texas has always been one of the more fashion-resistant places in music. People there feel that if something's good, they'll listen to it. That explains why so many blues and soul artists find audiences there even today, when the trends have long left them behind. And as rock historian Ed Ward shows, it may account for the career of Bobby Patterson, an almost unknown soul singer who deserves a bigger audience.
About the good old days. He said, boy, you should have been around there. We used to sit out on the front porch and eat watermelons after a hard day in the cotton patch. And on Saturday night, shoot, we'd go out in the backyard and watch them chickens hatch. Whatever happened to the good old days? Where have they gone? Whatever happened to the good
Back in the good old days, which weren't too long ago, American music was regional. National hits would come from regional breakouts, and of course, some regional artists remained regional. That's the only excuse I can think of for my never having heard of Bobby Patterson. He was born in Dallas in 1944 and grew up with his family playing blues around the house, as well as the music coming out of a neighborhood bar. So his picking up a guitar and learning to play it was perfectly normal. At the age of 16, he won a contest that sent him to L.A. to record, but the record company never issued the single he did there. Back in Dallas, he kept on playing any time he could, going to college at the University of Texas at Arlington and recording for tiny labels. One of his college friends bragged that he was going to get his father to start a record label for him, and then the brag came true. Abnac Records was born. Bobby and his band, the Mustangs, were among the first to record for them. Then You'll Know wasn't issued when it was recorded in 1965, but it was a first-rate effort showcasing the brand-new Mustangs in all their glory. Abnac, though, seems to have thought that a more pop-oriented sound would be better, so Bobby's first released record for them has a very Motownish sound.
I'm gonna hold you in my arms till you give in.
Till you give in.
I'm gonna hold you in my arms till I win.
The records, good as they were, weren't selling. But fortunately, Bobby Patterson and the Mustangs were a top live act in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and made a decent living touring and playing. A hit record, of course, would have been nice. He recorded a lot of answer records, talking back to the likes of Joe Tex, Wilson Pickett, and James Brown, but none of them hit either. Closer to the mark was this manifesto, which he delivered in late 1967. For whatever reason, it took Bobby forever to get a hit. Abnac was completely behind him at this point, having made some money from a white rock group, the Five Americans, who'd had a number of regional hits and a huge national one, Western Union Man. But it wasn't until 1969 that Bobby Patterson and the Mustangs went national.
Ah!
Take care of business or turn yourself around is what Bobby told people the chorus meant, although in private he's got another explanation for TYA. Its simple, Stax-like chorus and funky energy propelled the record to number 38 on the National Soul charts, but it proved to be his only stay there. It must have been because his sound was just a bit behind the times, because he continued to make remarkable records.
A little girl stood in a courtroom, yeah. Creature so warm and wild, yeah. And born too small for a woman, features too old for a child. I tell y'all how it happened, if you just listen to me. You see, my mother and father are dead, and little brother and sister were home, begging for a piece of bread. Then the judge told her, Mary McGuire, if you're guilty,
The trial of Mary McGuire was socially conscious and had the kind of melody that results when a country songwriter tries his hand at soul music. But again, the song went nowhere. Not too long afterwards, ABNAC folded and Patterson went on to Jewel and Malico, two labels specializing in Southern soul. Eventually, he became a promotion man for Malico, but he dreamed of being on stage again. And apparently, he's back. He's recording again and has a radio show weekday mornings on KKDA AM in Prairie View near Dallas. There's a whole generation of younger fans who missed him the first time around, and Bobby Patterson intends to show them what soul means.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed Soul Is My Music, the best of Bobby Patterson on the Sundazed label. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
What's your problem, baby? Why are you always so good? What's your problem, baby? Is the world mistreating you? You got everything you need.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Shooting the Sun by Max Bird, a novel of the expedition in 1839 to photograph the solar eclipse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, commentator and former Republican strategist Kevin Phillips. His new book, American Dynasty, argues that for generations, the Bush family has used its ties to oil, investment banking, and the intelligence community to reward friends and build political power. Also, Afghani film director Sadiq Barmak. Earlier this week, his film Osama won a Golden Globe. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.